This episode is brought to you by Audible, the leading provider of audiobooks. Book Riot listeners can download a free audiobook on us and get an extended free trial of the service by going to audiblepodcast.com/bookriot. This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 58. We're recording on Friday, June 20th, 2014. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I'm here with Jeff O'Neill, and we're the editors of BookRiot.com. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you.
I hope you had a lovely vacation.
I did. I baked myself in the sun with plenty SPF 50.
Is that the highest you can get?
I have 75 that I use on my very freckly face.
Oh, but that's like liquid aluminum foil.
This is like how you know you're a ginger, is I went through a family size pump bottle of SPF 50 by myself in 4 days. but I read some good books, and I had a great time listening to you and Amanda on the show.
Oh, yeah. Well, you had a good time.
Last week.
So we've got a couple of things to mention before we get into the show. One is we had enough demand for our summer Read More Books t-shirt that we're doing another small run of those that will be available through June 29th. If you go to teespring.com/readmorebooks2, or you can find the link in the show notes. You can get those. They're $20. They're fun, good for summertime frolicking.
Yeah, we've got red shirts and blue shirts and crew necks and V-necks and things for ladies and things for gents.
That's like a very Seussian read you just did. That was nice. It just kind of came off.
Why, thank you.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, there's ladies' cuts, fellas' cuts. No kids. We don't have those yet.
We should do a run of kids' bookish shirts at some point. I just ordered a batch of Read Me Books onesies from our friends at Word Bookstore for all of the people that I know who are having babies.
Yes, so maybe those are excellent.
Maybe we should do a Book Riot bookish baby something or other.
Yeah, we'll have to figure that out. So check those out, and if you're so inclined, that would be great. Another bit of follow-up that our good friends over at Oyster, I wish I had a drum roll button or something. Android. Now
yes,
available on
finally.
Android.
A little sooner than we expected. I think they had said it would be fall.
Fall. Well, they heard a lot of feedback, I think. We were hearing a lot of feedback. Mm-hmm. So you can get it on Android. You can get it on your Kindle Fire since it runs Android. Get it on a Nook since it runs Android. So now you have no excuse not to try Oyster. There's a free trial that you can go through. They didn't pay us. This is not a sponsored ad read,
right.
I should say.
They do sponsor some shows, but they didn't sponsor this one.
Because they kind of didn't need to, because we have to talk about this. So that's a nice bit of news.
And I guess
news.
If you don't know Oyster, the quick pitch is it's all you can read ebooks for $9.95 a month.
Yep,
Oysterbooks.com.
Right. And they say now they have some insane number of titles, 500,000.
Yeah, it's
crazy
more than
like
it's more than 500,000, and they just got Simon and Schuster on board recently. So they have HarperCollins and Simon and Schuster, which is two of the big five. Simon and Schuster has all of Hemingway's backlist, which I'm taking advantage of right now because my Jeff summer reading assignment was A Movable Feast, and I'm doing it.
Yeah, you are. I wonder if they thought people are traveling and they're reading and we should strike while the iron is humid.
You know, it
this
makes,
summer.
That would make a lot of sense. They also rolled out some new themes and like ways that you can poke at the text and font and adjust it for your preferences within the books. And I've been messing with that because they've had a nighttime reading mode for a while that inverts the colors. So the background of the page is black and the text is white, which works pretty well for reading in a dark place. But they rolled out also a new theme that the ad copy in the email that I got specifically says is great for reading in the sun or on the beach. So I think you're on to something there. They're wanting the service to be available for people during summer travel and vacation. And, you know, like everybody's talking about the books they're going to catch up on over the summer, and Oyster is all backlist. So that makes a lot of sense.
And sooner is never bad. If you can get it shipped, ship it, baby. All right. So let's do our first read. We'll get into the show. So Audible is back. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks, over 150,000 titles to choose from, fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, all the categories you've likely heard of are on Audible. Free apps on your iPhone, Android, Windows Phone. You can download and listen anywhere. unlike a streaming service, you own the files, so you can, you know, you can even if you stop your membership, you still have those files to listen to after the fact. They've got Audible's got a really great syncing program. It's called WhisperSync, where you can switch back and forth between your Kindle and your audiobook. Audible's owned by Amazon. Without losing your place. And also they added to Kindles a one-tap button where you can switch between audio and text and not miss a beat, which is really sweet. I don't know what else to say too much. That's the deal. Now, here's the deal. You go to audiblepodcast.com/bookriot, get a free 30-day trial, which includes an audiobook of your choice. Hard to say no to that. Mm-hmm. We got picks.
We do.
My pick I'm listening to right now is A More Beautiful Question by Warren Berger. And the subtitle is one of these mushy, make you feel like you know everything, the power of inquiry to spark breakthrough ideas, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, it's like, it's sort of pitched at business people, but it is about why questions are so useful as thinking tools. And I'm kind of on a pseudo business book kick. I've just finished Before This Creativity Incorporated by Ed Catmull, and then I'm starting Design as a Job by Mike Montero. So it's interesting. It's 7 hours long. It's a little more self-helpy kind of talk than I was anticipating, but there's a lot of good anecdotes about people that asked interesting questions that led to revolutionary change in whatever field they were in. And it breaks down kind of the four stages of questioning, from investigation, interrogation, illumination, and I think implementation, something like that, where this is kind of how turning a question into action works. Anyway, I find it very interesting. It's A More Beautiful Question by Warren Berger. That's my pick this week.
I'm going to analyze all of the conversations that we have about work stuff.
Yes.
Through the lens of knowing that you're reading that right now. I have an Audible pick too that I'm like filling in gaps in my reading, which is a thing I try to do every summer, but I am finally, for the very first time, encountering The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams.
Yay.
I know, it's so fantastic. Like, I just felt like I missed that critical point when I was a teenager that everyone seems to read the books, and I hadn't gotten around to filling them in yet, but there are several versions available, and Twitter overwhelmingly recommended the Stephen Fry narration to me, and so I haven't experienced the other ones, but the Stephen Fry one is awesome. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. There's so much great wordplay and whimsy in the stories, and Fry does these incredible voices for all of the ridiculous characters, including like animated sentient colors of blue, like shades of blue that have personalities. I don't know.
Yeah.
If you know the story, you know. But it's just really been a fun way to encounter it, and I've been feeling as I'm driving around listening to it that I don't know if I would have liked the story so much on paper, or like I have a hard time sort of seeing the movie of something in my head when I'm reading it. I think it's just so different that I might not have gotten it, but listening to it, having someone read me the story with all the characters' voices, is really bringing it to life. And it's like 5.5 hours long.
Yeah, they're not very long.
Yeah. Right. This first one is great. I'm probably just going to mainline the rest of them through the rest of the summer. It's been really fun so far.
I have never read or listened to the narration by Stephen Fry. Adams and Fry were really good friends. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he's got a little extra juice for it there, though he's a great narrator in his own right. All right. So that leads us to the week's news. We got a little more follow-up.
Lots of fun things this week.
Was this with you and I, or are you, me
yeah,
and Amanda?
Yeah, this was 2 weeks ago. Talked about this.
We talked about George R. R. Martin, who was basically, it wasn't really an auction, just making available, if you wanted to pay $20,000, you could have your name serve as a character who dies in an upcoming Game of Thrones book. And someone bought it.
Yep.
And unsurprisingly, it's someone with too much money at Facebook.
Right. A Facebook employee named Dave Goldblatt paid $20,000 to this wolf sanctuary in Santa Fe, which was the charity that George R.R. Martin had designated. And he raised more than $350,000 for the cause throughout this fundraising effort. But so now Dave Goldblatt is going to be the name of a character, which is just so fantastic.
And Dave Goldblatt was decapitated summarily. Right. Yeah, I don't know.
He says he wants to be a Valyrian, if at all possible, but he doesn't want to impinge upon Martin's creative process. He's just going to leave it to Martin to decide how he will kill Dave Goldblatt in the next book. I haven't read these.
I don't know it either.
I only know what I pick up from Twitter and Facebook of people talking about the stories. But my understanding is that Dave Goldblatt is not the kind of name that George R.R. Martin typically goes for.
I think we said that. I wonder if he's going to Westeros it. Like, can he turn it into some sort of, like, I don't know. Maybe there can be some sort of, he can be Davos Goldblatt or something. I don't know. Who
knows? Interesting. I wonder if there's a Game of Thrones name generator online. I feel like
that's interesting.
There should be, where you plug in your name and it Westerosifies it.
It is kind of amazing how much we know about it without knowing it, right? I mean, I know Tyrion Lannister and Cersei and dragons
Joffrey
and wildings and just through
rapiness.
Let's move on from there to something less controversial, like prisons. This is another bit of follow-up. We talked about probably about a month ago that there was a prohibition on sending books to prisoners, but one publisher, Andrew Franklin of Profile Books, volunteered to spend a night in jail with a Jeffrey Archer novel to raise awareness and raise money for, let's see, what exactly is the name of the...
Let's see, do they have an
organization?
It doesn't
say what the organization name is.
Yeah, this is in the UK, and they had 18 people volunteered to be locked up overnight, but there were only 6 cells. Mm-hmm. So they did fundraising, I guess like the bigger picture fundraising version of dropping pennies in the bucket for the organization that you want to receive the money. So 800 donors stepped in and raised more than £50,000.
Yep.
For this effort. And then 6 publishers are spending a night in jail in efforts to raise money and awareness now to raise
Howard League for Penal Reform.
Okay.
In the UK. So sounds like a prisoners advocacy group.
Yeah, to lift the ban on gifts of books to prisoners.
So people are doing some stuff. We like
that. Yeah, that's creative. Good on them.
Well,
not much else to say about that.
Not much else to
say
about that. Let's do some stats.
So reading is fundamental.
That does a lot of interesting stats that we've read about on the show before. And this is about what parents say their priority is for the summertime with their kids. Mm-hmm. And it said only 17% of parents say reading is a top priority this summer, according to a new survey. More than 1,000 parents with children ages 5 to 11 completed the survey online in April. Let's see. More than 60% of parents in the survey said they do not believe their child loses reading skills over the summer. Let's see. Its results are highlighted, blah, blah, blah. On average, parents say their child spends 17.5 hours a week watching TV or playing video games, 16.7 hours per week playing outside, and only 5.9 hours per week reading. I linked this in Critical Linking this week, and I said, this maybe doesn't sound that bad. Am I wrong about this?
That's what I've been thinking too. Like, and I'm not a parent, but I remember being a kid in the summer, and I was a bookish kid, but I don't think I spent more than, well, they're saying the average here is 5.9. I probably spent
eight or 10 hours
a week reading. Right. It seems to me like this is, I love reading is fundamental. And so I am torn about what I'm about to say. But it seems to me that this is another let's all be scared about this headline and pass it around headline that's not actually that troubling. And even the phrasing of the headline indicates that they want you to be worried about it. Only 17% of parents believe reading is a top priority in the summer. There are lots of priorities for families and kids in the summer. I think they do have a good point in this piece that we'll link to in the show notes, that even though 60% of parents say they don't believe their child loses reading skills, there's a lot of existing research that shows that summer learning loss is a major problem for kids across subjects. So reading skills would be one of those. But you know, 2 or 3 hours a day playing outside. I guess that also includes like if you're going to the pool or going on hikes or whatever, and 5.9 hours a week reading. Like that's pretty good. You and I have both talked about just trying to get an hour a day to read in our adult lives. And so if I had to break out the time that I spend, you know, like what, 8 hours a day looking at a computer, an hour or two a day reading, 4 hours a week at the gym.
I'm just thinking in my summer times, if we're talking about kids, what they say, 5 to 11, a lot of that summertime for me was spent with friends in the summer and just like kids in the neighborhood. And you very rarely you're like, hey, let's all get together and read for a while. You know, it just doesn't really. And I also thought it was weird that they lumped in watching TV or playing video games. Like, I wonder if they have separated those out. The 6 hours a week of reading maybe would even seem better, right? Because if let's say, even if let's say if 5 hours a week of that is playing video games, then the headline is kids spend more time reading during the summer than playing video games.
But that's just not convenient. Well, that's for what I'm saying. That's
exactly
around,
right.
Jeff.
That's exactly what I'm saying, right? And if it's, you know, if it's 12 hours a week watching TV and 6 hours a week of reading, they spend twice as much time watching TV in this. I'm like, that doesn't seem terrible. Like more reading is better, blah, 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 whatever. But this one just didn't really.
It just feels like there's kind of no meat on the bone here.
Yeah, I was trying to think what,
like, it's,
what
you know,
question would you ask?
Like, I mean, parents who consider reading to be extremely or very important are twice as likely to have a child who reads every day. Okay, that's intuitive. If you value reading a lot and you think it's important, you are more likely to make your child read every day. Mm-hmm. Or to have, you know, one of those little magic bookmarks that has the timer on that, that you set that then dings when you've met your quota. And then, you know, children who were involved in a reading program were up to 2 times more likely to read every day, which is cool. You know, lots of libraries do over the summer, lots of libraries do summer reading programs that encourage kids to read. And it creates that kind of competition element, I guess, of, you know, at least filling out your little bracket of all the books that you've read.
But only 2 times more likely to read every day if you're in a summer reading program?
Right.
I mean, I don't know what kind of multiplier I'm expecting, but.
Well, and I think this read every day bit is interesting. Like, I understand where literacy organizations come from with encouraging parents to read to their kids every day or to make their children read every day and to make that just part of their daily lives. But there are days that I don't read.
Sure.
You know, and I'm sure there are days where you don't read, where like a book is just not a thing that you've got a moment for in that day. And so I think it's interesting to be holding parents and kids up to a standard that we don't reasonably expect adults to do, or I don't think it's reasonable to expect an adult to absolutely have reading time every single day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. 82% of parents said their child preferred print books for summer reading, compared to 7% preferring tablets and 4% preferring e-readers, which only adds up to 94%.
That bit makes me wonder about how many of these kids have had a chance to try reading on tablets or reading ebooks, how much of it is like a default preference. My kid prefers print books. That is the only kind of book they have access to. You know, that's, I feel like there's
maybe you could compare it. Do they have daily access to a tablet? And that would be a sub question. Like if they do, what's their preference?
Right. If you're using the library, which like that's how I made it through summers as a kid, was those trips to the library with my parents where it was like, you can check out as many books as you can carry.
Right. Yeah. There's probably some bias in the numbers because a lot of they say twice as likely to read if you're in a summer reading program. So your reading choice at most libraries for kids, it's just easier to go browse the books and do whatever you need to do there. Anything conducted online?
Yeah. You got to wonder.
Got to wonder about that. I do wonder a 12 to 18 year old
what that would look like.
So anyway.
Yeah, I wonder, that would be really interesting. Did you have summer reading assignments in high school? Things you had to read before school
not
started?
That
you
I didn't? Remember, no.
We had, I think going into freshman year, we had to read one book over the summer. And then it was 2 books going into sophomore year, 3 books junior year, and 4 books senior year that you were expected to finish before school started.
What happened if you didn't, like, what did they do the first day? They give you a quiz? That sounds horrible.
Yeah, that's actually what they did over the summer. going into my freshman year was Fahrenheit 451. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, like, I think I've talked about it. I had an incredible teacher for that. So you read the book on your own, and then it was the first book of your first unit of English class in high school. And he was great. And I think we mostly reread it as we were going through talking about it. But I do very clearly remember struggling through All Quiet on the Western Front the summer before my sophomore year, which was before my love affair with war novels began, and having a not awesome teacher and like having to sit down and take a quiz on that book on the first day. I don't remember what the other assigned book was. But there were, going into senior year, we had to read a bunch of Henry James short stories and some other things. And you had to show up, like, and it was honors. And so I don't know if they, if the standard English students had to do the same assignments, but you had to like show up on the first day with a short story that you had written over the summer that was related to or inspired by Daisy Miller.
So weird.
I'm not still thinking about it 14 years later.
I did the as I think a lot of kids did, the Pizza Hut's Book It thing in the summer.
Yeah.
Where if you read books, you got, I think for every 10, you got a free personal pan pizza. Mm-hmm. And let me say, I got a few pizzas a few summers. Pizza Hut actually started in Wichita, Kansas, so I don't know if that was like a Midwestern thing, especially, or if that was a nationwide program.
I did that growing up in Kansas. Also, and then the local libraries had the things where you got your little tear-off form.
Yeah.
And then I think you could probably fit 20 books on, and when it was completed, you took it back to the library and you got something. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what it was, but I remember thinking that was cool. I think, though, the kids that are going to be motivated by a book reading competition are probably, like, those are the kids that are most likely to be reading on their own.
Yeah, I wonder, anyway. Like, what actually added reading time? I mean, probably you got another, probably Book It squeezed another 20% of reading out of me during the summer for some pizza I would get. I don't know. Who knows? But you wonder how many kids are like, I don't really want to read. Oh, do I, like if I read 10 books, I get a pizza? Maybe.
Like if Maker's Mark would do this for adults, I will. Books for bourbon. I'll do it.
That would be really funny. All right. More kind of smallish news all over the place. Mm-hmm. So if you've been sitting on a big Sherlock Holmes fan fiction novel,
now's your time.
Now's your time, because the Seventh Circuit Court ruled that Sherlock Holmes is now officially in the public domain. So a Sherlock Holmes enthusiast named Leslie Klinger filed the case against the Doyle Estate while he was preparing a short story anthology of his own. In Company of Sherlock Holmes, well, that's a bunch of contemporary writers that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of do fractured version of existing Sherlock Holmes stories. So agreed the copyright expiration meant that Klinger doesn't need the permission of the Doyle Estate to publish the book.
And neither do any of the people that are currently doing Doyle Estate sanctioned basically fan fiction of Sherlock, including the BBC's Sherlock series, the Warner Brothers Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr., the CBS series, Elementary, just to name a few. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about this. I would like to see a gender-shifted Sherlock Holmes
You know
now.
What? I think Michelle and I were talking about, we're into the CBS show Elementary. It's pretty good, actually, if you're looking for something to catch up with this summer. There's a bunch of episodes. I totally agree. Right there with you.
Because Lucy Liu is Watson on Elementary. And it's cool that there's a Lady Watson. But it makes me wonder if the reason we haven't seen a gender-shifted Sherlock yet has something to do with the estate not approving it. And now that that's out the door.
Moriarty in Elementary, spoiler alert, is a lady in Elementary. Ooh. Which is, there's a nice dynamic there. So that's not all the way. Oh, you know what? This, in the same article, it's kind of a roundup at Entertainment Weekly. There's this other story I forgot to link to. It's about the sales of Hillary Clinton's book.
Yeah.
Hard Choices sold 85,000 copies its first week.
Which sounds like a lot.
But I guess it's not great. I'm not really sure. Clinton's
2003 memoir.
Wait, was that hers or was that Bill's?
Living his... It says... I don't remember. I think it was hers. Her 2003 memoir sold 600,000 copies.
So maybe we've already gotten... people were already getting their Hillary fill with Living History.
But she doubled Mitt Romney's first week sales of No Apology. In his first week, he sold 42,000 copies.
Yes. Living History was by Hillary. So I'm guessing that sucked up all the oxygen. Maybe that's what's happening, is people thought they got their Hillary book already.
Also, it feels to me like the early part of the summer is a weird time to drop a big memoir by a political figure.
A giant, and it's like an 800-page hardback. Like, it's not super easy to take on a plane.
Right. I heard you say on the show last week that Michelle was listening to it on audio, and that it's like 30 hours long. And I've been debating, like, do I want to spend 30 hours? Mm-hmm. Can I even spend 30 hours listening to an audiobook? I don't know that I can. I'm not buying this thing in hardcover and lugging it around. But the ebook is almost as expensive as a print copy.
Oh,
the last
time
I looked, the ebook was $19.99. And I mean, I love Hillary.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, presidential candidates do this in the year or two before they're getting ready for the big run. They kind of get everything on the record and, you know, deal. Like, and this one was a lot of the stuff people were interested about Benghazi and kind of trying to set their record.
Have you
straight-ish.
Seen like any advertising for this book? Because I was thinking about if I didn't live in the book journet and spend time looking around at new titles and, like, you know, paying attention to what people are talking about on Twitter, I don't think I've seen anything publicizing this. And I do remember when Living History came out, seeing it places.
I saw banner ads on the New York Times. I remember seeing that. But I also pay attention to book-related ads online, so that could be some selection bias on my part as well.
I just wonder how much they've...
I don't know.
When a book doesn't sell well, there can be all kinds of reasons for it, and publishers often don't acknowledge the fact that if they don't spend a lot of money advertising a book, that contributes to a book selling well or not.
I mean, doubling Romney's book in 2012, like, I guess that was after the election, so that's a lot less interesting, too.
And she was much more in the spotlight in the media in 2003 than she is right now.
That's interesting, yeah.
You know, in 2003, we were coming up on election years.
Now she's the presumptive Democratic candidate, and she's been through the vetting process once already. We feel like we know her, blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's go on. So we like to highlight Kickstarter. So why don't you walk us through this
one? Yeah, this is some friends of ours at Housing Works Bookstore in New York, run by Amanda Bullock, who does their events there, and some friends of hers. They do a Moby Dick marathon every 2 years, where it's like a 3-day live marathon reading of Moby Dick. Regular people from their community of customers sign up to do spots, like to take an excerpt and to read it. And they also, because they're an awesome bookstore in New York with lots of connections, tend to get great authors signed up as well. And so if you follow it online, you get to see, like, oh, this awesome, cool person who's a best-selling famous author is standing in Housing Works reading a chapter of Moby Dick right now. And they move between a couple bookstore locations. They do themed snacks like chowder and all sorts of things. And so the Moby Dick Marathon launched a Kickstarter yesterday with the goal of raising $5,000 just to cover some of their production expenses and to enable them to grow the marathon in new and exciting ways and do some better publicity for it and who knows what. And so you can look for, if this sounds awesome to you, which I think it's pretty fantastic. I'm not sold on the idea of marathon readings, but I want to hang out with these people planning their marathon reading for 3 days.
And it moves all over the city, if my memory serves. They do it in several different places and a bunch of different authors.
And they have some sweet Moby Dick related swag that you can get if you back this Kickstarter. So they're trying to raise $5,000. It launched yesterday morning at the time of this recording, and they already have $3,200 lined up. So they're going to hit this goal.
Yep.
And then some. But if this is the first you're hearing of it, or maybe you've been to the Moby Dick Marathon in the past and you want it to be even bigger and better, then you can look for the Kickstarter link or search for Moby Dick Marathon NYC on Kickstarter and throw them some of your dollars and get some Moby Dick stuff.
Sweet.
Yep, that's one of my favorites. Cool Kickstarter things. Oh, can I talk about this next
one? Yes, I love this story.
So this has kind of been traveling around online this week, but it's about what happens when you share a book title with Stephen King. He had a novel out last year called Joyland that was sort of a pulpy throwback story that he only published in print. And at the time, I think we talked about, like, why would an author do this when ebooks matter so much to people? And there is a Canadian author named Emily Schultz who also has a novel out called Joyland. It's from 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And she realized that people were leaving negative reviews on her Amazon page, but they were not referring to her book. So people had gone onto Amazon searching for Joyland by Stephen King, but searching for the ebook and finding themselves unknowingly buying the ebook of Emily Schultz's Joyland because there's not an ebook edition of Stephen King's Joyland.
And so some of these crazy. Negative,
right? Some of these negative reviews are of the I bought this book and it's not actually by Stephen King. But she got a crazy high royalty check. I don't think she said how much it was for.
No, she didn't.
But she got a royalty check and realized that there were many more of these people accidentally buying her book than she had bargained for. So she's launched a Tumblr called Stephen King Money. It's stephenkingmoney.tumblr.com, where she documents
how she's
doing with the royalties that she has earned from people who bought her book when they meant to buy Stephen King's. It's great.
It's so great. And I guess enough people know the name of the book and they see that they search for it on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
and they don't know what the cover looks like, presumably.
Uh-huh. And they just don't pay attention to the author's name?
To see the author's name, which I think is so weird.
I know. Like, I found last week that one of the things that I do for Book Riot is insert the Amazon affiliate links into posts. And I was searching for The Secret History by Donna Tartt last week. Uh-huh. And I just put in Secret History into the Amazon search bar. And it popped up like 20 things that weren't Donna Tartt before it popped up Donna Tartt.
Oh, because that's like a little chestnut of nonfiction titling, The Secret History of X, right?
And many of them were just called The Secret History or, you know, The Secret History of Salt or whatever. And I could see how it's possible to be like, oh, I'm looking for The Secret History and this thing is called The Secret History. But like, people, really, you're buying books without looking at the author's name?
And I don't think there's a mechanism where she could just blanket refund everybody.
No, and she said that when she realized what was happening, because she was reading those negative reviews on her Amazon page and putting it together that people were looking for Stephen King and not her, she contacted Amazon about changing the metadata mm-hmm. on her page and about changing where she comes up in search results so that this wouldn't happen. But she did not receive any response from Amazon.
And I think if you buy, you can request a refund through Kindle. So if people were really been out of shape and they could request to get their money back, and I think mm-hmm. there's a mechanism for that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think it's her fault.
Right.
Amazon probably could do something to help people out. But I think if you're buying books online and you don't check to make sure, I don't have that much sympathy for you, I have to admit.
It's like if I buy a t-shirt in the wrong size because I didn't check what was listed on the tag. It's not Target's fault
right.
that I ended up with the wrong t-shirt.
They can take your return if you want to do it that way and, you know, go through the trouble of doing that. But What an odd stroke of luck.
Yeah, and the Tumblr is great. She shows each item that she bought, how much it cost, why she bought it, and then would Stephen King like it? So there's like a purchase, various IKEA items with a photo of her standing in IKEA, cost $94.70. The note: some cliches are true. When Brooklyn writers get a payday, they shout IKEA run and high five. And then would Stephen King like it? IKEA is just waiting to be used as a perfectly uncanny and terrifying setting.
Oh, there's actually a mystery thriller set in IKEA. I saw it at
BDA. Is
there
really?
I'll look for the title. Yeah, it's actually being passed around. It's not out yet. It's called like Horror Straw with like those two little umlauts over one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't remember. I'll find it. But it is a setting. You're actually on the money for that.
There should be some sort of like relationship self-help book with IKEA as like different stations in IKEA mm-hmm. as different stations of like premarital counseling. Like before you can marry someone, you should have to like
buy a couch with someone at IKEA.
Right. You should have to survive an IKEA trip, go on a vacation, see each other through having the flu.
Yeah. Like, double stomach flus and right. Thanksgiving at in-laws.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There you go. You got it pretty much wired.
But
what a weird unintended consequence of King making the decision not to have an ebook version.
Yeah.
Probably didn't anticipate a bunch of people misspending their dollars because they couldn't. And it must be happening at Barnes and Noble and Apple and Google and all these other places you can buy books.
I was trying to think of, you know, this probably happens with overlapping titles or overlapping author names all the time.
Yeah,
But we're hearing about this because so many people look for Stephen King books and he is just so widely read. So I've been trying to think about, like, who else could this happen to? Like, maybe if there was another Dan Brown or some other author named James Patterson.
Well, it happens where leeches in the Kindle, in like the self-pub part of the Kindle, will upload and it'll get it taken down, but they'll title their own fan fiction 50 Shades of Grey just to try to like get the people who are clicking the wrong link and sucking up some. But that's a different, that's actually fraud.
Right. But there are enough people clicking the wrong thing that it's a thing that people think is worth trying.
All right.
Anyway, StephenKingMoney.tumblr.com.
Yeah, that's what a weird windfall. Oh, Kansas, come on.
I know. This is a bummer. You have to take this one,
man. So, Leawood, Kansas, which...
not far from where I grew up at all.
Yeah, it's a suburb of Kansas City, right? Basically, Leawood.
Yeah.
Brian Collins, who lives in Leawood, installed a little free library, which I think we've talked about on the show before. And if you don't know what it is, it's basically a little free library is basically a cabinet or just a couple of shelves that you put out in your front yard or a park or something, and you put books in there and people give and take books on their own recognizance. It's kind of been a thing recently.
For the last year or two.
Swapna, who writes for us, has been doing a little series about her, the comings and goings of her little free library. I always like to see her updates, how to run one, how to be a good, responsible citizen. But Brian Collins went out of town for a few days last week, and we came back. He found a letter from the city saying him that his little free library was not permitted under city code because it was a detached structure from his house. And he had until June 19 to come into compliance. So he's got to attach it to his house.
Which means then people have to walk up to his house.
Which is super weird.
Right. To use it. This is just bad, Kansas. Like, and if you're a taxpayer in Leawood, Kansas, I imagine you're thinking, this is where my tax dollars are going. Like, of all of the things that we could be paying city officials to do, we've got city officials who are worried about someone giving people free books from a cabinet in his front yard. Just, I mean, bad job, Leawood. Have you seen any little free libraries in the wild?
Yes, there's one in Carroll Gardens, my old neighborhood in Brooklyn, and there's another one around here in Dimmis Park somewhere. Don't be creepy and triangulate my position. But yeah, I've seen them out in the wild, and they're not attached. And there's a picture of the Collins with his son Spencer, and he's put a little couple of stepping stones from the sidewalk, and there's a little bench next to it where you can sit down on it. And it's so cute that whoever wrote the citation should have just evaporated into Grinchness as they were walking.
I was just about to make a Grinch reference.
Right? I mean, seriously. And so let me get this. So like lemonade stands... you're not supposed to have that?
I mean, maybe because it's supposed to be a permanent structure where a lemonade stand is.
But this thing looks like a chair with a shelf on. I mean,
yeah, it's like
to call this thing
a
structure is like stretching the law,
really
the definition. And like, what about those play sets that are like huge? This thing is smaller than like one of those plastic play set Fisher Price things.
This person needs a hobby. And I think someone, I tweeted this from the Book Riot account yesterday, and someone was like, well, what if he'd bought a second mailbox and labeled his second mailbox as leave a book, take a book? Would that be acceptable? Because mailboxes are acceptable as things that are not attached to your house.
Or
would
it
be unacceptable because
of
the mail?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's, but I mean, it's just of all the things to worry about. This is not
bad job government.
This is bad job government. There's, we might have some in Richmond, but I haven't seen any little free libraries in Richmond, but there's one there's one standing on the sidewalk by a community building, in my husband's parents' neighborhood in St. Louis. And every time we go, there are different titles there. Like, we go walking past it whenever we take a walk in the evenings, and often the titles change from day to day. People are using it. Like, this is a free community service. Let Brian Collins keep his little free library.
The city administrator Scott Lambers He responded with an email, and he said, I would suggest that citizens who are interested in this endeavor contact the Johnson County Library to see if it's an activity that the library would permit. So you're going to attach a little library to the big library. That's what we're going to do.
When big libraries have babies.
It's like little library barnacles.
That's the show title, Library Barnacles. Like, what would even be the point of that? This looks like this would make Leslie Knope's head spin.
Yeah, I feel like we need to have an intervention here for Lee Wood.
You just can't be bothered to walk all the way into the real library, so we've put this little free library in its yard. Come on, man.
And you see this Spencer, he's got his sports sandals on, and he's standing. I mean, come on, man.
You're killing a 9-year-old kid.
You're killing us. This is all right.
Book sharing dreams. I just can't. All right. This is not cool. Let's talk about our other sponsor.
Let's do our other sponsor.
This week, the show is sponsored by How to Tell Toledo from the Night Sky by Lydia Netzer, which comes out in early July. And this is a great novel. I love Lydia Netzer, and I read the book several months ago. It's about two astronomers. The woman spends her research time trying to create black holes, and the man is setting out to use astronomy and what he can detect in the universe to prove the existence of God. So they're coming from really different perspectives, but they find themselves at the Toledo Institute of Astronomy, which is one of the premier places to do astronomy in the country, and they start to fall in love, but then they also start to figure out that their mothers knew each other and were friends since childhood, and actually their mothers wanted them to fall in love with each other and marry each other, so they raised them separately to be soulmates. Like, you know, they would both moms would read the kids the same obscure poem at bedtime, or sing them the same songs. And so when they're first meeting each other and first getting to know each other, it seems like they have all of these things in common that no one else would know. But it's not serendipity. It's not, you know, sort of that accidental bumping into your soulmate. This was very planned by their mothers. And there's this big question at the heart of the book that is, can true love exist if it's planned? Could this thing even work? There are unintended consequences, of course. And the couple discover the secret and start unraveling the other family secrets that they have. And so on the big level, it's about fate and determinism. But Netzer does this great thing in her fiction, which is also present in her previous novel called Shine, 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 where she weaves in sort of big science ideas and stuff about space and robots and the universe. And so it's not just a love story. It's not just two people falling for each other and unraveling these family secrets, but there is lots of great other, you know, sort of hard science elements with this softer love story. And I think her language is really quirky and interesting. There's a defined voice and a rhythm to the way that she writes. So the book, again, is How to Tell Toledo from the Night Sky by Lydia Netzer. It's going to be available, of course, as an ebook and as an audiobook. And she has an e-novella that is coming out also called Everybody's Baby that is unrelated, but that we've been talking about on the show as well. So thanks to them for sponsoring. Lydia's been a great friend of Book Riot's from day one. So we're really thrilled to have the book and to be able to talk about it. But I can tell you that it's great because I read it on vacation back in January.
Thanks so much for sponsoring the show. And you can find it anywhere books are sold.
Yeah, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes.
So one thing I like to do especially is talk about data and statistics that are running counter to the larger cultural narrative that books are dying and publishing is going belly up and we're all going to just sit around playing Candy Crush until the apocalypse. Jane Friedman linked on her site this week to actually a graph that Publishers Marketplace put together that I think was behind a paywall, which is I didn't see it. I don't subscribe to Publishers Marketplace. But she pulled it out, and it showed how much money the big publishers actually make. And it's 2006 through 2013. And, I mean, if you just sort of listen to the world, you would say there's no way that publishing profits is up more than 20% over the last 6 years. And yet.
And yet.
In 2006, the big five, well, then the big six, now the big five, put them all together. They did $8.6 billion in revenue and did $817 million in profits. And then in 2013, they did $9.2 billion in revenue and $1.007 billion in profits.
Wow.
So really, the profits are even up more than revenue is up, percentage-wise. Mm-hmm. And they attribute to a lot of that to the growth of digital, which the production cost kind of stay the same. There are more expenses incurred, but you've done the editing, you've done the cover design, you've done the advances. And the author royalties on ebooks tend to be a little bit lower. That may change in the future. But it did dip from 2006 to 2009. It went from $817 million of profits to $735 million in profit. So if you want to make an even stronger case for the strengthening of publishers, you could chart 2009 to 2013. In that case, profits would be up something like 33% over the last 4 years. And we have, I think I've mentioned on the show over the last couple of quarters, that the 2013 results for most publishers were actually pretty good. HarperCollins, Hachette, all had double-digit profit growth. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess if you work for a publisher, that's good news. If you like the way books are published now and the ecosystem around books as it is right now, this is probably good news. If you're an author, I guess it's good news. I'm not always sure that the interests of publishers and authors align quite as neatly as people suggest they do, but I'm not an insider there.
Yeah.
What do you think about this? I mean, is there anything other than just, turns out? I mean, other than that.
Yeah, it's super interesting that the data is not congruent with the dominant narrative about what's happening in publishing. Mm-hmm. But it really makes me wonder then, why is that narrative the dominant narrative? Like, what is going on in publishing that we're, you know, the profits are up, things are actually doing okay, but all of the headlines and the like scare quote stories that get passed around on the internet every week are about how books are dying. Like, does it simply come down to people being afraid of new technology and the transition from print to digital, even though like digital is helping make publishers more profitable, mm-hmm. And cutting down on expenses? Like, is that it?
Well, I think it's...
Or like, what is there to be gained from the like this really negative narrative that we hear all the time when the numbers don't line up with it?
I think, and you tell me what you think, but it's probably the visible sign to us of publishing strength is the physical bookstores we see around us, right?
Mm.
Well, and Borders has gone belly up, Barnes & Noble has been contracting, and over this same period, independent bookstores have been contracting. So I think it's counterintuitive for most people to think, look at all these bookstores going away, and yet publishing is making more money.
Right, it's how
than
can
ever.
Books be okay if bookstores aren't
right.
okay?
Right, and I think that's something, you and I have talked about off the podcast ourselves, is like the correlation between the health of bookstores and publishing are not necessarily inextricably linked.
Right. Yeah. I think you're right there. There's conflation of a lot of different factors and like conglomerating them all into one big story is like bookstores are not healthy, so publishing can't be healthy, mm-hmm. or individual authors' earnings are down, and so publishing must not be healthy.
Or Amazon is putting the screws to publishing, so they must be really getting nailed by Amazon.
Whatever is going to happen to readers, and it does turn, and like we're not hearing from readers very often who are concerned for their own reading experiences or for their access to books, or for the amount of good books that are being published. But we've talked about how what's good for publishers might not be the same as what's good for readers. What's good for books, like long-term, big picture, might not be the same thing as what would be good to save bookstores. But all those things get bundled up together into one giant like health of the book world, state of the book world measure.
The other thing that's
and
not,
all of oh, those are just like feelings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is different. Like you can no longer go to that Barnes & Noble that was in your town and go look at the books. Like that's a material change. Now, it doesn't mean that the overall trend is changed, but it's a material change in your life. They don't talk about middle-sized or small presses here.
Mm.
And there could be that there had been under more, like you need scale to compete in some of these new markets and the way things are bought and sold online, especially now. So that's one thing. These are the biggest publishers that have consolidated and changed their operations to do better in this new world that we live in now. So I'd be interested if there was like a representative group of, you know, 20 middle-sized to small publishers, what their earnings and sales have looked like over the same period. I don't know if their margins have been compressed or expanded or not. I have no idea, but that's one limitation of the data we're looking at right here. All right. Let's see. What do you want to do next? Let's do a little Amazon follow-up just while we're on it. I thought this was interesting. We've been talking about the Amazon Hachette showdown.
Yeah.
And leave it to J.K. Rowling to break, to some degree, the detente. When the book first came out last week.
Or wait, or was it this week? The Silkworm.
Last week? This week?
It's this week. It came out this Tuesday.
So it was being offered on by Amazon.com as shipping within 1 to 2 months. and then people got pissed on Twitter, on Facebook, on Kindle discussion forums, and filing complaints and questions with the site. And since as of Friday morning, that suggested that expected wait time is 1 to 2 days to process.
Yep.
So leave it to Joe.
And I also saw, I think part of the story here is like Rowling can push
units,
these things to happen.
Right.
Rowling moves books and that's compelling to Amazon to back down on that title by title basis. But I also think Amazon is paying closer attention to the action that individual titles are getting, individual Hachette titles are getting, than they're acknowledging, because Amazon doesn't publicly acknowledge anything.
Right.
But Carolyn Kellogg, who blogs about books for the LA Times, I saw her tweet yesterday that she had looked up The Fever by Megan Abbott, which is a new book this week, which is a Hachette title, on Amazon. And Amazon, I think sent her an email. This was on Twitter, so details are hazy. Either she got one of those like automated emails from Amazon, or the next time she went to Amazon to look at The Fever, they had put back in the pre-order button for it, because she had already looked up that Hachette title, and Amazon thought, you know, since she had looked for it once, she might be likely to spend money on it. And so it opened up, at least for her, in whatever their you know, algorithm is that's happening over there, the option to pre-order the book and to get it at the right time.
I mean, it feels like this is turning into we've always been at war with Eurasia situation now, where Amazon is going to concede the titles that will hurt them the most. I mean, they're losing tens of thousands of sales of The Silkworm, and maybe they we'll concede on that one, but we're going to keep the rest of the backlist under pressure.
Right.
And then Hachette's well, 80% of our sales are frontlist titles, so.
Yeah, you've got to think, if this were Random House and there were a new Dan Brown book, that Amazon would be doing the same thing, that you might not be able to get your Margaret Atwood backlist from Amazon, or the, you know, another less well-known author's backlist title from Amazon, but that, like, by God, they're going to sell their 6 million copies of the new Dan Brown on release day.
Well, we've long wondered what would happen if an author, a high-profile author, and you get no higher profile than J.K., you know, if a few of them got together, or a few of them under one house, and just said, you know what, we don't like Amazon, we don't like what they do, you just can't buy our books from them forever, and they pull all their books. Like, it shows you that people don't care about Amazon when it comes to books. They care about the books. Like, one reader wrote in and said, you don't get between a reader and her J.K. Rowling. And I think that's indicative, right? Like, people aren't loyal to Amazon. They use Amazon to get to the thing they actually want. They don't actually want Amazon. They want the Silkworm.
And that when Amazon is the cheapest, easiest, fastest way to get things, and people value cheap, easy, fast, then they use Amazon. But it's not about being loyal to, it's not about being loyal to Amazon. It's not like Amazon has this, you know, active and thriving community of Amazon fans who love each other and talk to each other about how much they love Amazon. It's that Amazon is a vehicle. And if somebody has a faster car, you know, to get you to the place that you want to go, and then that's what you get. If you want your J.K. Rowling, if you want your Dan Brown fix, like, there are if it's new Toni Morrison day, I am ordering new Toni Morrison from the place that I'm going to get my fingers on it the fastest.
Yeah.
And that happens to be driving to the indie bookstore 10 minutes from my house, you know, but if someone else offers me faster, mm-hmm. I might reconsider. And I think that we're seeing that here.
Right. Like
with Amazon, maybe Amazon overestimates the degree to which people actually love Amazon rather than the particular things that Amazon provides.
That's
them
right.
With.
Especially when it comes to books and authors. And that's just one small part of what they do. I don't know who I was talking to. Maybe it was Clint, but I was saying, it's kind of like, I think of Amazon as like an airline. Like I'm not excited to get on the plane.
Right.
Well, I might be only insofar, though, as it's getting me to where I want to go.
Right. Like, you're ending up in...
I'm in Honolulu, right? Right. Honolulu is the thing I'm excited about. And I happen to choose your airline because I got the best price at the time that at night... Well, maybe I got an exit row or whatever. But if your airline went away, I'm still going to Honolulu, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going some other way. So I think this is one thing we know. You and I know this also from what we do online, is that certain authors and certain books have such wattage that they can really shape the way people think about mm-hmm. their experience of buying and reading and living their lives online.
Like Stephen King is one that would be a great example. When he did Joyland and he did it in print only, some of the talk there was about, you know, critical feelings that he has, critical thoughts that he has about ebooks, mm-hmm. but the print edition of Joyland was still available through Amazon.
Right.
So we've not yet seen a big author who has some power to throw around refuse to have their books sold on mm-hmm. Amazon. And I'm sure some of that might have to do with negotiating their contracts with their publishers and what would happen if Stephen King's agent started telling his publisher for the next book they make a deal on that they will not sell any of those books through Amazon. The publisher is going to start having that fear of like, well, if people can't get it on Amazon, they're just not going to buy it. And I think the story that we're getting here is, no, that's not true. Like,
well, probably some won't.
But people who want their Stephen King... Right. will likely find another way to get it. The problem being, for some people, there aren't other ways to get it, or the other ways are more difficult because you live in a book desert without a bookstore nearby or your local library system.
But is you that could true? Though? I can order on Barnes & Noble.
Right,
you can get a Nook edition. You can get a print edition. You can order on Powell's. Like, I think book deserts for physical bookstores are real, but for online ordering, I kind of feel like it isn't
right.
real.
There's an alternative for online
I mean,
ordering.
Maybe you pay a little more. Maybe they don't have the quick fulfillment and all those other things. But
it feels like this weird catch-22. Like, there's all this fear of Amazon from publishers. Or what would happen if publishers stopped working with Amazon? Or what would happen if they told Amazon that they couldn't have the new J.K. Rowling book, but everyone else could? And I just really want to see someone, some publisher or some author walk up to that line and actually do the, okay, so what?
So what?
Like, what will actually occur if I don't sell my books on Amazon?
I mean,
let's find out.
It'd be harder to pick than Rowling. You'd have a harder to find a good candidate than Rowling. Like, someone people love, they're going to find it no matter what. They're going to go out of their way to get it. Like, maybe not as Robert Galbraith. I mean, people know that now. But, like, if there were a new Harry Potter book and she was just like, you know what? Amazon's been a thorn in the side of my publisher. I don't like what they do for X, Y, and Z reasons. It's going to be available everywhere else, but just not there, and I'm not into it. But, boy, that would be interesting.
If it were another children's book or another book in the Harry Potter universe or something, like, there's a community around those books. Bookstores do release parties for them. There would be so much real opportunity to bring people into bookstores or point them towards other things. If you had to go to jkrowling.com to get your information about where her next title was, and it was like, you can buy books in all of these places, and there were little icons, and just one of the icons was not Amazon.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
It would be a really interesting experience. I just want somebody to call Amazon's bluff. Like, let's actually find out what happens when a big author refuses to sell their books to Amazon, or when a big publisher just pulls their whole list. So we have some data instead of just this like gloomy cloud feeling of something bad would happen. Like, what is the bad thing? How bad would it actually be? Would it hurt your bottom line?
Yeah.
Would readers just go find somewhere else to get your books?
I mean, I wonder how many readers actually like, okay, let's say they couldn't get books at Amazon and they live in a book desert. Do they not know that you can go to Barnes & Noble online? Do they not know you can go to Powell's online? Like, there could be some just educational gaps there. Mm-hmm. I don't really have any experience with talking to people like that. So anyway, that's interesting that she was a big enough draw and Amazon decided to yield there. And that tells you a little bit about who's wearing the pants.
Right. And I guess I'm interested in hearing from listeners too, if you happen to have been looking for other books that are published by Hachette from other authors, if you happen to have experience like seeing those buy buttons magically reappear or seeing the delivery times look right again, and we'd be curious about which titles that was happening for.
Let's skip Rush Limbaugh being a jerk and go to new books here.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's go to something happy. So I mentioned The Fever by Megan Abbott is a Hachette title. It came out this week. It is awesome. Megan Abbott writes these great noir, sort of tightly wound thrillers, maybe not quite thriller, but suspense stories. And she lately has been tackling stories set in high schools. A couple of years ago, she wrote Dare Me, which is like Mean Girls and Bring It On, but darker, like teenage cheerleaders doing horrible things to each other. The Fever is about what happens in a small town high school when one girl collapses, having a seizure in class one day, comes down with a bunch of strange and unexplained symptoms that no one in the local medical community can figure out what's going on with this girl. But then a bunch of the other girls, like dozens of the other girls in the school, also start coming down with similar symptoms, and there's no visible organic cause for them. So there's a lot of fear in the community, and there's a lot of speculation. Maybe it's the HPV vaccines that all the girls just had to get for school. Maybe it's something in the water. Maybe it's something from a local like treatment plant that has been poisoning the soil. Nobody knows. And so everybody's reaching for possible explanations, and it's tapping into this like community fear. And the story is pulled, like the inspiration from the story was pulled from a thing that happened in real life in a small town a couple of years ago, where girls came down with symptoms like this. And ultimately, it was determined that this was kind of a modern day case of mass hysteria, for lack of a better term. Really? It's technically called conversion disorder, but where like tapping, like kind of what happened in The Crucible, but in a modern day tap that girls live in incredibly pressure filled and anxiety producing situations, these teenage girls do. And strange physical things happen as a result of those psychological pressures. This is like, it's super dark and creepy. There are some sinister things happening between the teenage girls, but also just great tension built in the community of people around them that are trying to figure out what's happening. And I think Megan Abbott is just so smart. There's, even if you kind of think you know where the story's going, you don't, or at least I'm never able to predict what she's doing. So that's The Fever. It's out this week. You might have trouble getting it from Amazon, but I'm sure you can find it many other places if you're looking for it. And then some great new paperback releases also. Longbourn by Joe Baker is out in paperback this week. It's the Pride and Prejudice story, but told from the perspective of the servants in the house, sort of a Downton Abbey flip on things, or upstairs, downstairs. Got tons of praise last year. I am not personally a Pride and Prejudice fan, so I didn't read this, but pretty much everyone that I love did read it and loved it. It showed up on Book Riot a bajillion times. It's Longbourn. Longbourn is the name of the manor. So if you're into Pride and Prejudice, you know, so many different takes on that story have come out in the last few years, but this one has been widely regarded as one of the good ones, one not to be missed, and also seems to me like it would be a good thing to read over the summer. And The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri is out in paperback this week as well, which I have not read. Did you read it?
I did. I felt like you it's did. Good. It's classic Lahiri. You know, it's first and second generation immigrants. It's good. I would recommend it if you liked any of her earlier books. It's quite good. So also The Silkworm, we just said, right?
Oh, right, yes.
Just so we know.
By Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling.
A.k.a. J.K.
A.k.a. J.K.
I think that's our show.
That is our show. I'm just going to sit here giggling about a.k.a. J.K.
You know, I was just thinking, what if George R.R. Martin's next book wasn't available on Amazon?
Ooh. That would be interesting. But then how would we find out what happens to Dave Goldblatt?
Yeah, Dave is getting his meeting his maker in the next book, or is it just sometime?
Oh, I don't know. I think I just assumed it was the next book, but who knows?
Who knows where we are in the process. As always, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Reading Ape. She's at Rebecca Shinsky, S-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y. If you want to find show notes for this show or back shows, you go podcast.com/bookriot. You can drop us a note. podcast@bookriot.com. If you want to send us an email about whatever strikes your fancy, got a question, a comment, or idea, a clarification, or a correction, we are always looking at that. If you are in a really super happy, good giving mood, rating the show on iTunes, go on iTunes and just search for Book Riot. You will find the show there, and a rating and review puts us, gives us some algorithm juice with Apple. And that's the number one way people discover brand new to them podcasts. When they're searching around there, if you got more ratings and more reviews, you're more likely to show up when people are searching for things like book podcasts or literature podcasts or podcasts with witty, charming, and deceptively good-looking hosts. You never know who's going to show up there. The Teespring, teespring.com/readmorebooks2. You want to find that. And boy, is that our, what else are we putting
we
on display?
We want to thank Audible and How to Tell Toledo from the Night Sky for sponsoring the show this week.
Yep.
And if you happen to be listening on Sunday the 22nd, we're going to be hosting a live chat on the site at 8 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, June 22nd, for summer reading recommendations.
Yep.
Where you can tell us, this is what I'm in the mood for, and we will say, here are some books that we recommend.
As always, thanks for listening. I'm going to go start on my unpermitted little free library, and we will talk to you guys next week.
Have a good one.